For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
You're listening to the world's smartest podcast network.
When I go to Sacramento, I will pump up Sacramento.
Some say the news is fake. Others say it's real. These two don't have the time to check. Instead, Turner Sparks and Michael Ira Kaplan turn to comics stationed around the globe to be their eyewitness reporters so that you can know what's really going on. This is Lost in America.
All right, everybody, welcome to Lost in America Roundtable. My name's Turner Sparks.
I am Sir Michael Ira Kaplan.
You can find me at Turner Sparks on Instagram, turnersparks.com for all my tour dates. You can find Kaplan at Kaplan America on all social media platforms, Kaplan NYC for all your real estate needs. Kaplan.
Yes.
Today, we have the whole roundtable crew back together. Dr. Andrea Jones-Roy, Professor Andrew Heaton from the Political Orphanage, Andrea Jones-Roy from the Majoring in Everything podcast. We're talking about this Hasan Minhaj article. You know him from The Daily Show, from his own TV show on Netflix, from his stand-up comedy specials. I would recommend pausing and reading the New Yorker article, or at least skimming it a little bit. I guess you don't have to, because we will kind of start the episode by telling you all the things that are involved in this article. But if you're not familiar with it at all, at least maybe check it out. What do you think, Cap?
And you only get like 10 free articles, I think, the whole year they give you. They make it's a paywall. So if you haven't used them yet, yeah, click on it, read a little bit, skim it. But we're going to cover it as well. So you don't need
to. We'll cover it as well. Support our show, everybody. Patreon.com/Lost in America. If you subscribe for $5 a month, you get our Lost in the Bunker show. That's me and Kaplan, full throttle comedy, talking about our lives, our daily lives in New York City, Kaplan's kids, my stand-up my nights at stand-up comedy clubs. A lot of stories that I would not say in public because I'm talking about other comedians, or I'm, you know, ripping on other comedy clubs, but I don't mind saying them for people who pay $5 a month.
No, and if we are the victims of any sort of attacks, like we're going to talk about in this episode or anything, this is where we talk about it in Patreon. We don't talk about it on this show. So
$5 is where we will talk about it.
Yeah, you're going to hear all about Teddy's Little League season's about to start. I got a lot cooking. We got our film festivals we're applying to. Lots going on in our lives, so we're going to get into it.
We're going to go through every at-bat of his entire season.
Well, no, these parents are crazy. I left off the main. I already could see, because I'm on a text chain with the parents, and we haven't even had a practice yet, and I could tell they're some nuts. So I'm looking forward to reporting back about, you know, the crazy appearance of youth sports culture. Yes.
And $5 gets you that show. For $10, you get a t-shirt. The one time we went to number one in Armenia, we will mail you the shirt. It costs us money to actually print these shirts. We will lose money on this, but $10 gets you that shirt. $20 a month, you get your own ad on this show. We haven't done an ad from one of the Drew Fralicks, the Tugs, the Dennis Owens of the crew. Sugar Brady, we owe all of them an ad. You get your own once a month, you get your own ad on this show. And Kaplan, also for $5 a month, you get access to our monthly off the record show, where we have one of our guests from Lost in America come on and give us the full, unabridged, unedited, uncensored story of what they were talking about on Lost in America. So just last week, we had Andrea Jones-Roy. She recently, as a professor at NYU, recently left academia and gave us all the reasons why she's fed up with NYU and why with academia in general in America. And these students, this next generation of students who seem to be All I'll say is entitled, and if you want the details, there is no way to get the details now. It's live only. We don't record it so that they feel free to say whatever you want, but we're doing these once a month, so subscribe now, and then you'll get the email when we do the next one next month.
Yeah, she said she didn't leave academia. Academia left her, but you know, you guys didn't see it if you didn't watch, but we saw Tug was there. Sugar Brady was there. It was great to see you both.
Great to see everybody, the whole crew. Everybody was there. Out. Yeah. And that's it, I think, Kaplan. Should we get to the show?
Yeah, let's get to it. Alert the brains.
What's up, everybody? Welcome back to the World's Smartest Podcast Network Roundtable. We have convened a very rapid and hard-hitting roundtable to talk about the latest and greatest news that I think is at the intersection of all of our wheelhouses, at the intersection of comedy, politics, personal stories, and more. We are here, of course, to talk about the recent New Yorker article that is causing a stir called Hasan Minhaj's Emotional Truths. And maybe we'll talk in a moment about whether or not I'm saying his name correctly. So this is an article that came out in the New Yorker mere days ago at the time of recording. Oh, by the way, I'm Andrea Jones-Roy. I'm the host of Majoring in Everything. So excited to talk about this that I wanted to get right into it. I am joined by my fellow World's Smartest Podcast Network hosts, Andrew Heaton. Welcome.
Hello. A pleasure to be here. Always fun to talk to you all. But also, I love shitting on comedians who are more successful than myself. So this is going to be really fun for me.
The schadenfreude is ripe in the air. We're all very thrilled. I think we didn't convene a roundtable this quickly when, like, Russia invaded Ukraine. Like, this is where, like, we got to get together and talk about this. All right. I am also joined by the two co-hosts of the Lost in America podcast, Turner Sparks. Welcome back to the roundtable.
Thank you. Thank you for having me back on our show.
Yes. I am the arbiter of the roundtable today. And
we
Michael,
took a vote.
Captain.
You passed.
Yeah.
Good to see you all. I'm looking forward to discussing emotional truths with you all.
There we go. All
right,
so we're here
always.
Because we are dictated by nothing if not our emotional truths. So we all, I imagine, came across this article separately. I read it personally at about 2 a.m. I couldn't sleep. And the minute I started reading, it was like, Hasan Minhaj, Emotional Truths. He is a comedian who is very well regarded. He's being considered for all kinds of fancy options, Daily Show possibilities. He used to have a Netflix show. He's a hero of mine as far as comedic storytelling and comedy with a purpose and a message. Big deal, huge person in comedy. This article comes out and says, gosh, a lot of the stories that he has based his stand-up specials on, or his storytelling specials, we can debate which one of those are, it turns out are not quite true in a factual sense. They are true, according to him, in an emotional sense. And we can unpack what we all think about that in mere moments. But the article points out that a number of the stories around which his specials have revolved have been fake. The one that stood out to me, first and foremost, is from his first special, Homecoming King, where he tells a long, complicated, difficult to listen to story about wanting to go to prom with a white girl. He's Indian, practicing Muslim, wanted to go to prom with a white girl. And the whole special is all about how at the last second he's on the doorstep and her parents said, oh, we don't want a brown person in the photos. What will our family think? And he sees some white dude or someone else put a corsage on this woman. And it's all pretty, you know, upsetting if you think about, you know, racism, xenophobia in America. That one of the other big lies or non-factual truths that was brought up in the article was around an anthrax scare. Correct me, you all, if you know this particular detail better, but apparently he received some white powder in the mail, had been doing some political comedy, political shows, and was thinking that he was in some kind of danger, thought that his daughter had been exposed to anthrax. They go to the emergency room and there's a whole to-do about it. And it turns out that also was made up. There's a few other pieces in there that I think we'll unravel as we go. But the big punchline, you know, and the article itself starts with the question is, does it matter that this was not true? And so I, of course, wanted to talk about this with all of you because we have talked on this roundtable before about politics and comedy, a lot of social issues. Hannah Gadsby at length, who I'm a big fan of, who does a lot of personal storytelling and the line between storytelling and comedy, and what you can joke about and what you can't. So this has all those flavors all mixed together in one. I think maybe to kick us off, we should all go around and say, do we think it matters that it was made up? Heaton, what do you think?
Yes, I do. But it depends on what they made up. So actually, I had not heard the bit about the prom bit. I'm going to lay the cards on the table. I am aware of Hasan Minhaj. Minhaj. I'm aware of him. I've not actually watched his comedy. So okay. I am academically aware of Hasan. This article is the most exposure I've had to him. So I have not followed his career. Okay. I did not read in the article you sent, or apparently I skipped it, the bit about the prom bit. So his first comedy special, the Crescendo, was about how racist this community was and how he couldn't take the girl he wanted to prom. And that turned out to be false. That was made up.
And he, for those of you who, if you haven't seen it, I'm going to sort of spoil it. He uses screens and he puts up a blurred out photo of this person that he went to high school with, their Facebook profile, and shows that later on in her life, she married an Indian man who had a very traditionally Indian long last name. And he runs across the stage shouting out the name syllable by syllable. And it turns out that those people are very much real. I don't know if he used that exact name, but it was close enough that they were able to get completely doxxed and harassed. And this woman and her husband have had a really difficult a life because of this special and because he was not careful enough about their privacy. And then the whole thing was false, not on top of all of that.
Yeah. So noting all of this, I draw the distinction between are you lying in pursuit of the goddess we all serve, Thalia, muse of humor? Are you telling the lie in order to further the laughter of the audience, or are you telling the lie as a kind of entrepreneurial victimhood? And it seems to me that the lying that Hasan is engaged in is what I would call entrepreneurial victimhood, a new and fascinating phenomenon within world history and in particular within our culture. It's only about 20, 30 years old, if that.
I was about to give you credit for that term. I've never heard entrepreneurial victimhood before. Oh, that's great.
You know what? It started circulating as a term, at least insofar as I'm aware of it, when Turner, you were on my show for that episode back when I was doing a daily show. Who's the fella that that like claimed to have a noose around his neck and they shouted, "This is MAGA country," and they threw bleach at him?
Jussie Smollett.
That's it.
Smollett.
Smollett.
Subway guy. They was going to kill that.
That was when the term started floating around. So to me, these are different states. I think all of us exaggerate in comedy regularly. And in fact, I would argue that a lot of the time when people get angry at a joke, they're not really angry at the truth of the joke. They're angry at the exaggeration of it, which I think is fine. Jimmy Fela, who's in New York that some of us know, I'm friends with, he has a joke where... I'll butcher it, but he says, like, last night I got so depressed after the Mets lost that I went down to the 9/11 memorial to feel better. And people will get mad at him. And he's like, all right, do you honestly think that I equate the Mets losing with September 11th? No, you're angry of the proximity that I took this joke to something sacred, which I think is fine. I don't think that that's an offensive joke. I think that it's you're a little too touchy if you do that. So if you're exaggerating the joke for comedic effect, I don't have a problem with it. And to be blunt, if you're just making it up whole cloth to have a joke, I'm okay with that. Even if it's just to illustrate a point, I'm fine with that. I won't say which, but there's one of my favorite jokes that I regale people with when I'm in restaurants and in cocktail parties and things, is 80% a lie. But what of very few. But it's just the humor of the situation that I'm trying to do. It's not me lying that when I was in Oklahoma, everybody was really mean to me when I came to the East Coast. And I really struggled here because classism was really bad. Like, I'm not doing that.
Wait, pause for applause break right there. You got to, that's an
Peabody Award.
Let's go.
The problem I have is, I think Louis C.K. like even talks about this in one of his specials where he kicks off a special where he's talking about how sardonic and sarcastic people have become. And he's at a Starbucks and someone's like, yesterday I saw Becky. That's hilarious. And he goes through this whole thing and he made it up. That to me is okay because he's illustrating a point. And it, I mean, maybe I'm splitting hairs here, but he's illustrating a point and he's doing it for comedic value, but he's not creating a biographical rap sheet in order to further himself. And that to me is what Hasan is doing. He's basically engaging in a biographical retcon for his own benefits. And so that bothers me.
So that was one. I'm glad you brought up Louis C.K. because that was one of the analogies I thought of as I was reading this. First, I thought, oh, gosh, I exaggerate things in my own stand up. I say stuff that I said that I didn't say and whatever. And I was like, is that the same thing? And Louis C.K. has another joke where he says something like, oh, you know, he gets up. Someone on the plane got upset that there was no Wi-Fi on the plane. And the joke is that like 2 seconds ago, you didn't even know there was going to be Wi-Fi only because you heard that there's no Wi-Fi. Now you're mad. And apparently right. in real life, that was him. Having that reaction and then realizing that reaction was ridiculous, but in the joke, it works better if you say that it's someone else. So I guess he threw someone under the bus and he was making this up. I will backtrack slightly and say that there is potentially some room for defense of, or you could hear, I would imagine Hassan would want to defend himself along the lines of like, he didn't make up the prom story 100%. He was dating a white girl. She did say she didn't want to go to prom with him. But the circumstances of it being this like dramatic moment where he shows up on the door ready to go with her, like those details were what maybe compressed and they were fabricated. And so even then, it's not that he just made up the event completely in his defense.
But
Turner,
right.
what do
or,
you think?
Or with the anthrax one, according to him, there was like again, he might be backtracking, but in the original story, someone sends him an anthrax scare. His wife is terrified, et cetera, et cetera. And then he's now kind of said, well, there was something in an envelope. It looked kind of like powder. I don't know. So there might have been a kernel of truth to it. But,
right.
but the kind of orchestrated
but his kid didn't go to the hospital.
Hero's journey plot arc that he's created right. is much more exaggerated. Sorry, Turner?
Yeah, Turner.
Yeah, I think that what I find interesting here is that his lies, along the lines of what Heaton just said, his lies go to paint him in the end as either a hero or a victim. And that's just fundamentally, in my mind, an odd way to approach stand-up comedy. That it's, and again, maybe this is, we're going back to an argument or some, you know, you brought it up. You referenced it early, Andrea, that maybe this is not stand-up, it's storytelling or something like that. But, usually in stand-up, I find myself to be kind of the idiot, the punchline of the joke. Usually I wouldn't write a joke where in the end I'm so smart. Or I'm poor me, I'm a victim. That's just not where my comedy comes from. If that does, of course, we all have things that happen in our life where in the end something happens in our life and in the end it turns out we were right, right? Or in the end it turns out we were wronged by society. Neither one of those cases, when those happen to me, does that go ding 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 comedy time, ooh, I was so right, let's turn this into stand-up material. But one of his, so one a bit you didn't mention he talks about is when he was in high school, his mosque in Sacramento, California. Yes, also my hometown.
Yes, your home
where
mosque.
He is from. He's from your the suburb
mosque.
Of Davis.
Going to the bake sale.
Yeah, he's from the suburb of Davis right outside of Sacramento, but it's just a suburb. So his mosque in Sacramento was infiltrated by an undercover FBI agent. Yeah. And this was a white man who went by the name of like Brother Connor or something like
Brother
that.
Eric.
Brother Eric.
Brother Eric.
Brother
right.
Eric. Yeah. And Hassan, I think is how he prefers to be called now. Hassan, or maybe he always preferred to be called and people call him the wrong thing. Whatever. Hassan said that when he was in high school, he was the only one who he knew this guy was up to no good. He knew this guy was an FBI agent. This was shortly after 9/11. And as the great Norm MacDonald said, we all know the worst part about 9/11 were the, all the people.
Hypocrisy?
No, it's, he said the racism felt by certain people around the world, not the 2,500 people who died in the towers.
Right.
But anyway, so he knew, this is right after 9/11, he knew this guy was up to no good. And this FBI agent, and he told his parent, he told his dad, he told everybody, and no one believed him. They said, no, this is Brother Eric's a great guy. 10 years later, Brother Eric, who is a real person, is outed as an FBI agent who was infiltrating mosques, right? And Hassan is the hero because he says, look, I'm so smart. I knew before anyone else knew. And I guess I haven't seen that special, but I guess then I would assume the audience applauds. And that's funny. Anyway, turns out none of that was true. That man is an undercover FBI agent. He and even he's in the article. Brother Eric's in the article. He goes, yeah, I'm a scumbag. I was infiltrating Moss.
He was in Southern California, but he was in
I was in L.A. Sacramento. We're nowhere close. It's an hour flight. It's an 8-hour drive to L.A. We're nowhere near L.A. I don't know why he would make that up, but he did. So anyway, long way of saying that, yes, this is, I think that you're allowed to lie in comedy as long as it's the end of it is a punchline. I saw a comedian on Twitter say, in light of the revelations of the Hasan Minhaj story, this is the best time for me to say I never did, in fact, jerk off a homeless guy on the L train. But I did it to serve an emotional truth.
Right.
So anyway, point is, if it's there to serve as a joke, of course, that I think as a comedian, I think that's fine. Go ahead, Kaplan.
Oh, no, well, two things. One is that I'm totally cool, I hope you agree with this, with doxing girls in high school who just, if you want to build an entire comedy special, if it's your entire motivation to become a stand-up comedian, to have a special, to then dox the girl in high school who didn't want to go to prom
with you.
I mean, that's brilliant. I tip my cap to him. It probably was because he was a dork who would become a comedian, not because he was brown, but. Anyway, what he said I wanted to touch on was the idea of the victimhood. That's where I have the problem. It's because it seems like we're moving towards a society where, like, yes, like everybody, you guys are all comedians. Everyone exaggerates. There's a certain audience knows that going in. But it's like to exaggerate only to be the victim. Like you want, like in all times now, you need to, like, you know, I'm a Jew. And Turner and I have talked about this on the air before where I've said that I think Jews, one of the reasons we're like holding on to hope that we're discriminated against still, because that was good for comedy. It's good being the victim. And I think that
you want us to discriminate against you, Cap.
Yes,
that be
I root for it. It was okay. Great. Well, the peak of Jewish comedies when we could get into country clubs,
makes you feel better. I say anti-Semitic stuff about you all
the
time.
Say Jewess right now, and I will be funnier the rest of the episode.
Jewess. There is a thing though. If I can just jump in, Cap, real quick, where you will see comedians. I only really see it in New York, but they'll go into a room and they'll be like, hey, so I'm Jewish, like, and they just assume everyone hates them. And I feel like just a swath of tourists from around the world are just kind of, it's a little like it doesn't connect totally.
Yeah. And in this case, I mean, you know, after 9/11, there was tons of race. We know that's the truth, that we also know that, like, for America, considering 9/11, considering what happens in Europe, America actually in some ways did it wasn't like the worst case scenario, I guess is what I'm trying to say. We commended just, but he is seeming like, I don't know what he grew up with. I don't know if he grew up with racism or not. We don't know that, but he seems like he wants to have, it's like good for his shtick. And the fact that he doesn't actually have real stories here, like they're not even like, it's not an exact, the Louis C.K. thing is like, okay, he was on the plane. He had a thought.
Right.
This is like, I'm inventing, you know, this is not even close to the reality. So I think it does go, you know, in writing, you know, writers now, they say that, like, you know, people don't want to read a story unless you experienced it. That's a big controversy in the fiction world. Like, you should have experienced this thing. You can't get into some. And I feel like he's like doing that for the comedians. Like you need to have experienced something. So I'm just going to say I experienced it, and then I could talk about this issue. So I don't – whatever word you used earlier, he, and I like that. And
Entrepreneurial victimhood?
Yes, that's which, what I think which he's
doing. I'm glad you bring up the victimhood. I think that is what's going on. I think that there is a I think victimhood plays a role in comedy. I don't want to call it that. Let me rephrase this. I think that comedy is very much served by being the odd man out. I think that's that's a powerful place to be from a humor writing perspective. If you are, let's bring it back to high school. If you are captain of the football team and you're dating the head cheerleader and you're sitting at the cool kids table, it's a lot more difficult for you to look out at the universe and go, this is fucked up. I see some weird things here that no one else has noticed, because the whole universe is suiting you. And so when you're at the center of the wheel that the world is spinning around, which in our society traditionally has been white Protestant males, it's harder for us to see the incongruities in society, because when society is working very well for you, it sure feels like society is working well in general. Whereas when you're on the edge, you're on the periphery, or you're not being serviced by society, whether you're an ethnic minority, a sexual minority, a religious minority, whatever, it's a lot easier for you to be able to see those fissures and go, have you all noticed this odd contradiction here? So I think it's a powerful position to be at.
Heaton, that's the most woke thing you've ever said, by the way. I just want to like pull that out and play it at the start of all my podcasts. Keep going. Yeah.
So I think that there's real value in that. But again, that is in the service of the comedy. That's in the service of the humor. And I think that that's kind of a different mental mindset than a lot of the sections of our society where victimhood is good because it lends moral authority. And the more victimized I am, the more moral authority I have than you. And I've been in I'm always at the bottom of the pyramid as a straight white guy. Like now I'm Buddhist, so I guess maybe I can like take a little.
Are you good for you? Yeah, okay.
I was hanging out at Sangha recently and realized, wait a minute, I've been fucking doing this 5 years. I think this is what I am.
Coming out as a Buddhist.
Yeah, coming out as Buddhist. By the way, no discrimination on my end. Of course, I've only been, anyway. A point is like,
brother Heaton, we're going to call you.
I'm at the bottom of the pyramid, but I've kind of like I have friends. A lot of them are in New York who will like I can kind of hear them sort of angling to see who's got more chips they can put on the victim pile. And we should absolutely be trying to design a society where we're not victimizing people and where nobody's discriminated against. I'm 100% in favor of that. But I also I've got enough gritty Oklahoma pioneer in me to go, I do not think that conceiving of yourself as a victim is ultimately an efficacious way to navigate life. I think that that is a really prohibitive view to have. And so I don't think it's healthy for society to fixate on that or for people that have been victimized to view themselves as passive objects in a system. I think it's even if the odds are against you, I think it's much better for you to believe that you are an active participant who has a certain level of self-ownership and efficaciousness that you can inflict upon the world. I think it's a better place to be.
Without the ones like you who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Can I bring up the angle of his response here to this? Because I find his response very interesting. So we've all kind of established that, and I've talked to a lot of comedians about this over the last few days, and basically everyone has the same opinion on it that we all do, which is that, this seems weird. And this seems, frankly, like wrong. That especially the part of outing this girl he went to high school with, that, the idea that I think Kaplan said they dated. Well, that's not even 100% true. She says in the article they were friends. They were friends. And he asked her to prom and she said yes. And then a couple days later, a guy she actually liked was interested in asked her to prom. So she ended up saying no to Hasan Minhaj and then said yes to this other guy. And then he spent his life, and then he pulled a very Michael Jordan move. I don't know if you read the rest of the article, but he invited her and her new husband to come see the special without jabbing them off that the end of it was going to be outing them as terrible people. So he made up this stuff about a mosque in Sacramento. He made up all of this, the anthrax scare.
He made up his daughter getting anthrax. Yeah.
Calling it an anthrax scare. What you're making up is that you were the victim of a terrorist attack when in fact you're not. And his response to all of this. So he met with New Yorker, the New Yorker article. And before they published the article, they said, hey, let's meet and go through these facts and tell us what you want to know. Now, a lot of people would just be like, straight up, no, I'm not meeting with you. You're going to blast me here.
Yeah.
Or the second response would be you meet with them and you go, yes, I did all these things. Or you did, for a second would be deny, say like, no, all those are true. Third would be, yes, I did all those things and I'm sorry. And there's precedence here for this if we're talking about terrorist attacks. Steve Ranazzisi, a stand-up comedian in 2015, was outed by the New York Times as having lied, that saying he was in the buildings, the towers in 9/11. He never actually talked about this in his stand-up act. He moved to L.A., didn't have a lot of friends. Somehow, when he was 22 years old, decided to make this up as his origin story of why he got into stand-up comedy. I was in the towers. They got hit. I was working at Merrill Lynch as a banker. And I went, you know what? I got to change my life. Carpe diem. I'm becoming a comedian.
Like George Santos.
Whatever.
It is a good origin story.
It's a great origin story.
15 years later, this isn't true. His response was to profusely apologize, to go on the Howard Stern show and take callers of everyone telling him he's a horrible person. He agreed, but it did end his career. He's still a stand-up comedian now, but he's at no point where he used to be. Minaj's response was to admit that all of this was fake, but then basically say, F you, I don't care. Yes, it's true, it's fake, but I'm not apologizing. Which is...
Well, in the...
And to say it was serving this higher truth, right? So are we currently in a world where apologizing is kind of the worst thing to do?
So Turner, I'm so glad you brought up his response, because two things I think come from that. So one, in disclosure, the author of the article is someone named Claire Malone, who I worked with at 538. She's an outstanding journalist. She's very, very thorough. She does not mess around. I started reading the article. I'm a fan of Hasan Minhaj, or I was a fan of Hasan Minhaj. And also I was excited that it was Claire and it was this intersection. Claire is very intense. Like, I am amazed and impressed that she got an interview with him. And if anything, she went, I think, very lighter on him than she could have. Like, the article itself poses the question, does it matter that this was made up? She doesn't come out and say, hey, I'm exposing this person for lying to us. So if anything, she's rather forgiving of him. And you're absolutely right that his response, his justification of it, that, oh, it's what he calls an emotional truth. It represents a truth that a lot of people who experience discrimination go through, is justification enough. It's a surprisingly delicate article for what the claims are, the findings are. I find myself wondering how Claire got tipped off at the start as to how, whether or not this was fake. Does she know the person from the high school, the date or the homecoming thing? Did rumors circulate? Did she follow comedy more than I realized? Like, how?
Her husband's,
how do you figure this out?
And I heard that
she's gotten some flack for not going harder against him. So I guess Turner really brings up two things. Like, why, you know, should she have even given him a chance to reply if she's just exposing something that he won, you know, like a Peabody Award for like American storytelling and sharing the American experience? Like, it was above and beyond the comedy reception. And he was hailed as this truth teller. And is there any backbone to this emotional truth? Are we at all sympathetic? Best case scenario.
I have one more thing to say.
And then last thing here, and then I'll let everyone else jump in. But if you're going to say the concept of an emotional truth is that it didn't happen, which I think he's kind of invented this term in the last week. I've never heard this term before, but I guess the concept that he's pitching is that it didn't happen to me personally, but it has happened to someone in the world. And it does happen. It did happen in our society. So therefore it happened to me. I feel like Steve Ranazzisi should retract his 9/11 thing.
9/11 like, happened to us.
Well, it happened. So emotionally, there were people in that building. It is an event that happened in the world. So then therefore it happened to me. I will also say that I don't know Hasan Minhaj personally, even though we have a lot of similar friends because of our Sacramento connection and New York, but I've never met the guy in person.
Heaton. Emotional truth.
I find the concept of emotional truth very suspicious. I am very suspicious towards this. It does have an intellectual lineage in journalism. Like, I don't think they teach this journalism school, but I've been told from people that went to journalism school that there's a maxim: don't let the facts get in the way of the truth. So I think that there is something of this that's percolated for a while. But in terms of the application of it, I'm very suspicious for this reason. I see no difference between saying emotional truth versus making up things that fit my confirmation bias. I am not sure how they are in any way different. So let's put the shoe on the other foot for a minute. I make up a story where some MAGA Republicans say something super racist, because even though that didn't happen, my worldview is that MAGA Republicans are super racists. And so I'm communicating an emotional truth. Well, what I'm doing is bullshitting you and giving you a fabricated image that might in fact be warping your understanding of reality. Or let's backtrack to the 60s, where I'm a white guy in Pittsburgh, and I talk about how these black guys came into my store and started pushing around the girls and were you know, shoplifting and shit. And it didn't happen, but we all know what black people are like. Okay, that's the emotional truth shared by that particular people at that particular time. Mm-hmm. But also, you're doing a great disservice by perpetuating this. So I don't like that idea. I think that it is indistinguishable from this is my confirmation bias, and I am making up a thing to illustrate my confirmation bias. And so I'm not a fan.
I'm
not a fan of emotional truth. Cap,
I know.
What do you
think? I'm going to start using it. If I you know, going out to the strip club and my wife says, "What were you doing?" I'll say, "My emotional truth is I was at the library." I don't know. Like, what can do a lot with this? But no, it's interesting what Turner was saying. Like, are you familiar with the Mike Daisy? Does anybody know who he is?
Sounds vaguely familiar.
Exactly, vaguely. So that's my point. When I first moved to New York, like 15 years ago, he was this, like, it's not a stand-up comedian. He was like a storyteller. He would do these, like, monologues, and he was just very, very funny, and they were all about his life. And he just seemed like the type of person who would be, like, who should have made a bigger career, right? And then at some point, about a decade ago, he did this whole story monologue that was getting all these great reviews about going to China to the Apple, like, building the iPhone facilities. And he, like, got a job. I forget these specifics, but I think he supposedly got a job there, and he had all these crazy details. And then people fact checked it, and the whole thing was fake. And he initially
like he hadn't
did
gone to China at all.
Yeah, he initially. I think he went to China, but he initially did what Turner just said. Like, he doubled down and he said, "Well, he didn't use the term emotional truth, but he basically said I stand by my story." He did this whole thing. And then eventually he got so much backlash that he basically had to admit it was all fake. But like his career, I feel like I haven't heard the guy. Like he used to see him all the time at things. So it's a dangerous move, I think, as not. But I think he's counting on the fact that because it's stand-up comedy, like when you go to these storytelling shows, you it's like when someone writes a memoir, you know, like the guy, A Million Little Pieces guy. Like you as an audience member, you believe, like, you're interested in it because it's true. Like if it's a piece of fiction, even if it's there's that disclaimer in the front of a book that says these things aren't true, and we accept that. Maybe we need to start doing those stand-up comedy. I don't know. But there's something about, yeah, as the audience member, you give yourself to to someone who's saying that this isn't really happened. And then when you're robbed of that, I don't know. Like, he's counting on, like, Whoopi Goldberg, I saw, came to his defense and said that all comedians do this. Like, he's counting on that thing that people say all comedians make things up. But, like, I know Turner didn't really go apple picking, but and doesn't even have a Chinese wife, but he make most of his acts.
I have proof of both of those in my social media. We did go apple picking.
Exactly.
No, but of course, the apple picking story I have, there's parts of it that are made up, of course, right? But it's an emotional truth.
right, right.
No, but in no point am I the victim or anything.
Right,
I don't know.
The hero.
There's no... Yeah. No, can I say one thing?
And that's
here?
Where I think, Cap, I'm glad you said this, because it really does come back to, and I don't have a good answer for this, is like, why does it bug me so much that Hasan Minhaj made up big pieces of these stories when, in fact, we all as comedians make things up? And I feel like there's a number of different ways to go with this. I want to give you guys some hypotheticals. So one, yeah, what if we all just made stuff up? What if I just made up I was a professor? Turner made up that he lived in China.
I made up I had a heart attack.
He ran Mr. Softy, whatever it is. But it was still funny, and we were still telling a joke. Would that be fine? Would it be fine if I was just making up, say, the professor thing? I'm not a victim. I'm not anything. I just am talking about being a professor, and it's riotously hilarious, as everyone knows.
Yeah, I think if you've got a character like Greg Turkington used to do this with what was that guy's name? I can't remember. There was a very famous character Greg Turkington would do, but it was a character.
Okay.
I think
Stephen Wright.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know.
Stephen Wright has a joke where he goes, "I worked at a fire hydrant factory. You couldn't park anywhere near the place."
Yeah.
I don't think any of us believe he worked at a fire hydrant factory.
Yeah, okay.
Well, see, here's where I doubt everything I've said previously this episode, and I would like everybody's input on this. I'm making this delineation that seems there's a general consensus on of if you're exaggerating or even whole cloth fabricating something in service to a punchline, it's okay. But if you're doing it to retcon your own biography, it's not okay. So that's kind of the thesis I'm operating with. But I also wonder if I'm just making up bullshit to go, well, I like that guy, so it's okay when he does it.
Well, that's what I'm wondering,
and
too.
I don't know that guy. So
about myself.
I like the work of Louis C.K. I think his comedy is very, very funny. So I'm immediately intellectually coming to his defense going, well, it's fine. In his case, it's fine. In my case, I'm a great guy. And so I it's possible that this is all just me trying to explain in my head why you can do it if I like you and you can't do it if I don't like you or I don't know you.
Andrea, can I ask you this?
Go ahead.
If it came out that Hannah Gadsby was never raped.
Okay, she wasn't raped. She was beaten up, but okay.
Oh, I haven't seen the special.
Yeah, okay. I was like,
If it came out that she was never beaten up, there was no attack. Nothing ever happened.
Right.
This is someone you do like, right?
Yes.
Then would that
change
it for
you? It would absolutely change it for me. It would completely change it. I would lose a lot of, if not all of my respect for her. And, you know, I like Hasan Minhaj a lot. He's someone that I really look up to in the comedy world. And, I find it very disappointing. And this is my problem, is I can't quite figure out why. And so it's like, to give another example, like what if I told a joke about being raped and it was hysterical? I feel like that's wrong. I don't have a good reason for why. And so, Heaton, you're bringing up, like, if it's in service of a punchline, it's fine. That seems like it's not okay. And I agree that Hannah Gadsby, hers wasn't in service of a punchline in that moment. It was in the context of a stand-up show, but it was not in service of a punchline in particular.
So, okay, this is a great fissure point that we can explore, right? Mm-hmm. So I'm a huge Jack Handy fan. I think anybody that is in comedy that grew up in the 90s is a huge Jack Handy fan, whether you know it or not. Yep. And one of the lines in Deep Thoughts is, I've always been afraid of clowns. And I think it might have to do with the fact that one time when I was a kid, a clown killed my dad.
Yeah.
Right? Like, he's bringing up murder. So it's it's a big thing, right? Like rape and murder are both very serious topics. In that case, I look at it and I'm like, that's funny. Like if somebody said that on stage and they went exact same joke, and you know, a clown killed my dad, maybe it's because implicit in the joke, I know that they don't mean it. There's such an absurdist framework to it. So possible if you made a rape joke, Andrea, that had like, you know, I was raped on a spaceship or something like that. Like, a big caveat here, be fucking careful, and it has to be really funny, and I would probably never attempt this myself. But
I'm never going to do a joke on this, just so everyone knows.
If you were to do it in such a way that it was absurdist, I could see you pulling it off, where no one would really be offended by it, because you would not be it would be a joke in service of a joke. The reality would be clear.
Yeah, I think that it really all comes down to if you're trying to get a laugh or you're trying to get sympathy, victimhood or heroship. And that's it. Mm-hmm. That's frankly it. I think anyone can do a joke that if they got raped, and if it's funny, great, you know? And if it's sad and then it didn't happen, if it's sad, it better be true. If it's funny, do whatever you want. And I think all rape jokes are funny. So we're opposites. And that's it.
If it bends, it's funny.
He's been muted because he just keeps chuckling every time I use the word rape. So,
that's really where it comes down to for me. And I think where it comes down to for most people. I think I don't want to be one of these politicians who's like, America wants change, which is like vaguely saying what America is, to back up your own point. But I think it is true. I think America agrees with me in this sense. I think most people, if it's in service of a joke, they're like, say whatever you want. We know we're at a stand-up comedy show. We know what's going on here. And if it's ending in a joke, go for it. Cap, go ahead. Sorry.
Cap,
go ahead.
I think that you have to remember your audiences are all pretty stupid, right? So I do think that they think most things are true, I think. But then they know, you know, then they think later, oh, do you think that really happened? Like, so I think that if it's in the service of a joke, who cares? It's a joke. But like when you're making these big, giant points about American society, especially if you have the platform. You're not like doing a small gig somewhere. You're like on it's a television special. There is a sense of, I mean, his whole, if you're doing political comedy, right? If you want to be that person, or if you want to be the person who's doing rape comedy, whatever it is, like, you know, yeah. So
there's more to this. So do you know that also in the article, they say that he puts up behind him. I don't know if this is on one of his specials or in his TV show, but he puts up all of the racist tweets. And direct messages he's gotten sent to him over the years or whatever. And it turns out all of those, 100% of them were made up by him.
Wait, what? I missed that. Really?
See, that point is not doing stand-up comedy. He's doing performance art, or whatever you want to call it. And like, it's
I bring up entrepreneurial victimhood. That is an emotional truth he's fabricated. Like, if my whole set, I don't have a lot of victim cards I can play here, but if my whole thing was how mean East Coast elites are to me, being the son of farmers in Oklahoma, and that was my whole thing. And everybody would applaud, like, God, what a brave guy and all that shit. And like, then knock the stool out from under me. Mm-hmm. I also wonder, there might be a kind of backlash from us in terms of like the proper way to obtain status. Has anybody read a book called The Status Game by Will Stewart by chance?
Mm. No.
Absolutely phenomenal. You will never see the world the same way again. It's either Will Stewart or Will Story. He came on the Political Orphanage about 6 months ago, but basically what Will Storer proposes is, as primates, we are constantly, 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 without end, jockeying to see who's at the top of whatever hierarchy we're in at any given time. Mm-hmm. And that there are three methods by which we obtain status within our social group. We do it by domination, by bullying people, which could be physical in olden times, today bullying, or I would argue, like in the context of a lot of our conversations, calling people out for language they can't use to kind of let them know that I have the ability to put you down. You can do it by purity, by believing the right things, saying the right things, by knowing the sacred beliefs of your tribe, by a kind of moral integrity, or by prestige, by being successful, either by outward trappings, like presumably the reason that I wear a lot of blazers is that I'm trying to communicate to other people, look at me, I have prestige and success, but also just being successful. And so I think within the comedy world, unless you're a Don Rickles character who is, you know, made an act out of pushing people around, I only want to give you credit for prestige. I only want to give you credit for being very, very funny. And I want the comedy system to incentivize and reward being successful at maximizing laughter. I do not want to give you credit as a comedian for being morally pure. I don't give a fuck. I give a fuck about you being funny. And so when you start figuring out, instead of doing jokes, I'm just going to figure out how to be morally pure and the people will applaud me, it just kind of pisses me off.
Right. No, I thought of you all first when I read this article because of my, as we've discussed many times on this show, many of my friends, including comedian friends, are to the left of me and more censorious of language. And there are things you can make jokes about and there are things you can't make jokes about. And I am more careful around my language around them. And I like talking with you all because, yeah, if it's funny, then you can kind of say whatever you want. You can make trans jokes, you can make rape jokes, you can murder jokes, it's funny. And so this is the big litmus test. And I do think you're right, Heaton, that if we're trying to pull some other string, I'm trying to say, and also I'm trying to make a point about society or teach us something or make the white people feel bad. I'm going to be the victim here and say, wow, we need to change the world. There were other messages in his special and from his career over time other than this is so funny. And I guess that's the heart of what it is. It's like, you're making me feel something else, and now we feel betrayed. I think the second piece that we haven't brought up yet is that he has worked in sort of journalism. So his Netflix show, The Patriot Act, I don't know if any of you guys have seen it, is a kind of John Oliver Daily
Show. It's journalism for young people who don't actually
journalism for young people. It's one of those where just like Jon Stewart, just like Colbert, just like all the rest, they say, hey, I'm not a journalist, I'm a comedian.
They try to have it both ways.
But you're really presenting facts about the world. You know, this is what's going on in India. This is what's going on in the UAE, whatever. With a team of journalists and reporters working for you and telling these stories. So unlike the vast majority of comedians, Hasan Minhaj has had platforms where it's ostensibly news, even though it's certainly billed as entertainment. And so I think he in particular is one of those comics. Like if it turned out that Jon Stewart had lied about a bunch of stuff related to his political views, I feel like that would rub us the wrong way than if Turner made up, you know, the Mr. Softy story. Because you haven't made that your whole
imagine
point.
If Turner made up the Mr. Softy
right? Like,
story.
Oh,
that's
to, like,
coming.
Persuade
that's
us of something about China or business or ice cream.
I would be impressed if Turner had never been to China. I would at this point I'd actually also I'd be super impressed.
I'm
by
in
that.
On it. I made up. I photoshopped him into photos
it
of me in China.
It would actually be good for Turner's career because then we could get a New Yorker article about it. The guy who fooled
yeah,
around.
Yeah, I'll see if Claire's free.
But you know, and yeah, there's an outlet for all this. By the way, he could write a book. Like, that's the thing. Like, you'd write a novel if you want to cover all these themes. You could write a piece of fiction or write a movie. Like, you don't have to do stand-up comedy. It's not, like, the only form of entertainment. So,
I mean, I think one other piece that we haven't hit on yet, and I don't know that this is the crowd to do it, although, Cap, because you're constantly discriminated against, perhaps you can, is I spoke with some comedians who are also first-generation immigrants or second generation, I forget, their parents moved to the US and they've grown up here, and they tell a lot of personal stories in the context of their comedy about growing up Indian American or whatever. And they have expressed concerns that this will really cast doubt on anything that they say on stage going forward or any voices in the marginalized communities that Heaton was describing, where we say, well, this happened to me and this happened to me.
Yeah, then they make themselves into victims.
Making
are
it
they
about
preemptively
them?
Making themselves about them being victims immediately.
Like, I also want to say that I'm very concerned to talk about 9/11 after a white man, Steve Renazzisi, lied about being in 9/11.
Yeah,
I'm going to introduce a new term here. We've not brought it up in today's conversation, but we have brought it up previously. The concept of clapter, which I take a very dim view of. This has been going on for a long time, but I feel like it crescendoed during the Trump years, where you get up and you go, you know, maybe this isn't popular, but I think the president's a fascist, and then everybody claps, and you don't have to tell a joke, because telling a joke's much harder than telling a thing to a room full of people that everybody agrees with. So a lot of hacks did this and continue to do this, right? I feel like there's a kind of I, as a comedian, I think am viscerally chafing at something similar that we're talking about today with Hasan, of what I'm going to call laugh tier. I need to work on this term here.
But
instead of going for some combination of applause and laughter, you're going for some combination of sympathy and laughter. Mm-hmm. And I'm a goddamn purist. I want high distillate laughter. I don't want a laughter tier combo. I want laughter. if you want to have a deep moment that drags out the suspense, and then there's going to be a really big payoff, that's fine. That's part of the art. But if you're if you're going for, like, to me, there's almost like an emotionally sympathetic variant of clapter.
There's, and I just want to say, Heaton, that still exists. I think clapter is potentially at an all-time high right now, but on the other side, all across America, there's these hacks being like, can you believe in New York they still wear masks? And everyone goes, ah.
And start clapping.
It really is. It's just as high, but on the other side right now.
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to add some controversy here. I have heard the phrase claplause as opposed to clapter. So we can have a new round table to discuss. Wait,
isn't that just applause? Is it clap
applause
just applause?
When you get the clap and you applaud and you're proud of you. At least you had sex.
There's no laugh involved.
Never mind.
Clap-laws.
Yeah, you just... Okay, I'm an idiot. All right.
By the way, you reminded me when you brought up Trump that there was one other thing he made up that I thought was amazing. Did you catch that in the article about how...
Was it the murder of...
Yeah.
That's right. Yeah.
He went to an event honoring some Saudi activists, and supposedly there was a seat saved for the Saudi activists, and Jared Kushner just took the seat, and then he told him off or something. And it's like none of that happened apparently.
Is he a pathological liar?
He's just a hero.
Nothing to do with. Yeah.
And he met with the Saudis like a month before was murdered supposedly, but he made it seem like he met like a few hours. Yeah, he made it seem like he met with him like a few hours before the murder, which That I'm like, a month of.
Well, and the people were texting him saying, are you okay? Because yeah, he interviewed the Saudi prince the same day that Khashoggi was killed.
Which, it's an odd move. He made his entire TV show staff complicit in this lie by saying, my whole staff was texting me all day asking, are you okay? Right. Are you okay? Meanwhile, the whole staff knows. They go, this didn't happen. They're the only ones who know, but now they're not allowed to tell anybody that this is a lie because their boss is lying on behalf of them.
I think he's pathological. You're right.
It does seem excessive. I mean, there must have been a moment where after Homecoming King, which to me is what made me aware of him and winning a Peabody Award for that, where he must have been like accepting the award and been like, well, it's too bad I made so much of this up because people really seem to be taking it seriously. Like, I think that there must have been. And maybe there wasn't because he's gone on to keep lying.
He repeated those stories then in interviews in different newspapers and everything.
Yeah.
It wasn't like he just told them once on stage. But go ahead, Andrea.
No, I think we're all largely in agreement on this. I wonder if there's anything nice that we can say. What's the strongest defense? I want to challenge us to be on the other side here. What's the strongest defense of all of this?
I think the strongest defense is what he's doing, which is trying to use the shield of stand-up comedy to protect the lies and hoping that the general public and Whoopi Goldberg are too dense or too uninformed on the topic to know that this isn't what all comedians do. Because I think his best defense is what he's going for, which is don't admit guilt, but don't apologize. Never apologize is the post that Trump taught us that.
Trump taught everybody that. Never apologize. Keep going.
Yeah, so he's using the Trump model here of never apologizing. And then just hoping that you say, well, no, all comedians lie.
Yeah.
And so therefore you're wrapping yourself in the blanket of all comedians. I think he's doing the right thing if his goal is to preserve his career and never apologize.
I'll properly steel man this. I think I can do this.
Let's go.
Hello, I am Hassan. What I am trying to do is I am trying to punch up and communicate problems within our society. And my goal is to highlight these problems to the audience. I am less concerned about my personal relationship to the problems. I am merely using myself as the vehicle by which to explain the narrative. I'm fairly incidental. It's just that I'm the one with the mic, therefore I'm injecting myself into the story. But what I'm trying to do is bring these ideas to the American public, and the ideas are more important than the underlying details. So it's the thesis rather than the facts that I'm concerned with, and that's what I'm trying to communicate with my comedy specials.
He should hire you. Good. All right, Cap.
I was going to go the other way. See, that's why you're successful. My move would be to just make that your comedy, to just lie, to make fun of yourself, everything you do, just make fun of. Am I telling the truth? You know, turn that into a shtick, but he's not going to.
Well,
do
that brings up a good. That's a horrible idea. but that does bring up a good question, which is, who's going to believe his next special?
That's like, the thing. That's
where
why
does
he needs
his
to
career
address
go
it head
from
on.
Here? I know that he is. They said the Rolling Stone magazine reported the following day that he's still apparently a top three finalist to get the Daily Show. I'm going to take a real outside wager to say that that's not happening. No one's giving him. He's not going to be host of the Daily Show right now. If you can't believe what he's saying, you know, and then this is his style of comedy is like in quotes, truth telling comedy. That is his style, right?
Personal and story, Birbiglia.
Exposing the truth. So then if none of it's true. Yeah. I'm really curious. Where do you all think his career goes from here?
I mean, my initial thought was, well, because he's pushing his, I follow him on Instagram and he's pushing his tour quite hard, The King's Jester. And my thought was he was going to come out and apologize fully and cancel the tour. But I'm obviously wrong about that. And I haven't taken enough lessons from Trump to begin with. So I bet that I agree with what others are saying, that I think his stand-up career is maybe okay, but it will just be his diehard fans who, and we all, Heaton, you articulated this earlier, like we all have people who we're going to follow no matter what. And maybe it won't be as widespread, but he'll still have a ton of followers who say, yeah, you're speaking.
He's going to be just, again, as Hassan's PR person here.
Yeah.
I think we need to ask ourselves, what percentage of the public, or even let's narrow this down, what percentage of people that go to stand-up shows across the country are reading The New Yorker? I'm going to go with 5%, maybe max.
Way less.
Now let's subdivide that by people who read The New Yorker and don't like him enough to forgive him. I think statistically this is going to be very, like, I think most people, if you talk to them and go, what do you think about that thing with Hassan Minhaj? They're going to go, who? And of the people that know him, they're going to go, oh, I didn't read that. I didn't read The New Yorker article. I think this is going to be water off the duck's back. I think this might cost him the Daily Show impresario position. But in terms of the overall comedy arc, it's not like this is going to affect him at all.
It's not so like when Michael Richardson saying the N-word or anything.
Yeah. Why did it affect like Steve Ranazzisi so much? Because under the same logic, what percentage of comedy audiences read New York Times? And his career...
Good point.
He had a very good stand-up comedy career. He was on the League. He was one of the lead actors on this TV show, The League, for like 7 seasons. Yeah. The show was ending naturally, so it's not like he got fired from the show. He was launching this giant tour, and it all came crashing down. But the difference is he did apologize. Maybe that's the problem.
Maybe that's just a mistake then.
That could be part of it. Well, I'm curious there too, because like my guess is that you're going to find a really disproportionate amount of people that are at the head of creative institutions that read The New Yorker or The New York Times.
Yeah.
And you're not going to find that same percentage in a comedy audience. So I've heard about this guy Turner, but I'm surprised that he would cancel a stand-up tour.
But
I'm
Hassan is not doing a tour across like big clubs. It's him as the headliner. So the people coming to his show are him. It's not just the random schmo walking into the Laugh Factory in whatever town.
I've actually never seen him do stand-up, I should say.
I don't know if
we've just done an hour talking about a guy where half the people on the day have never seen him do stand up.
Yeah, I mean that's interesting.
It means that we're objective.
A World's Smartest Podcast Network live show where Kaplan and Heaton watch Homecoming King knowing that it's fake and then live commentary.
It's actually very entertaining stand-up now when you know it's fake. I did that 3 or 4 days ago.
Yeah.
And because after reading the article, I'm like, I'm so curious to see what his stand-ups, because I only seen him in clubs, but you know, I hadn't seen the full special, and it is wildly entertaining. When you realize
you went back and watched the special, Turner?
I watched the first half of Homecoming King, and there's one thing that's just so clearly a lie. He says when he was like 7 or 8 years old, I believe this part, that he was raised by his dad because his mom was still in India and she hadn't got the visa yet, or the green card. And so they're waiting on the green card. It took 8 years. And when his mom finally does arrive, this little girl, like she has this little girl with her. And he's like, he's 8 years old. And he's like, who is that? Who could that little girl be? And she's like 5, the little girl, 4 or something. And he goes, that's when I found out I had a sister. And there's just no way his parents didn't tell him he had a sister.
They didn't mention? They didn't say? I mean, I know they didn't have FaceTime back then, but they might have mentioned
like,
it in a letter.
When my dad had gone home to visit her, he knocked up my mom and then a sister came out. But that is, I guess you could say that's servicing a joke. So
yeah, and there's no real harm there, I guess. Thing. It's not, is it going to affect how any of you tell jokes like with the truth, or you're worried about?
No, because I didn't approach jokes this way as a hero or a victim.
Yeah.
It's never occurred
to me. I don't know anyone
who
does. Do you know anyone who?
Well, Turner, when we do our Patreon show, I'm always like, I used to be like so on like 100% and then I feel like I'm starting to exaggerate things a little more. I feel like the show gets better. But now I'm gonna be nervous to do that, so I'm gonna return to 100% accuracy. I don't want anyone fact checking.
I'll keep stealing Bob Newhart jokes. Doesn't affect me.
It goes back to where we started, which
it's
less about the, you know, yes, he stretched some of the details or compressed some of the timelines, but it's parts of it are true. Is the victimhood piece of it?
Yes,
and I think like you heighten things about when you went apple picking, and I heighten things about how horrible I am to my students. Yeah. But the fundamental claims are true, and none of us are saying, oh, feel so bad for me, I went apple picking.
Yeah.
Well, also,
when I had a heart attack, it was actually heartburn.
You were horrible to your students. So you, in this case, you're the joke's on you, right? Usually in comedy, the joke, you point the joke inward at yourself. But anyway,
right?
Yeah.
Right. Right.
So you all think he's going to be fine. You think he's going to escape?
He's going to be fine.
Yeah.
Yeah. I did check his Instagram.
I might actually go see him now based on this. If he comes through Austin, I might.
Yeah. I'm more interested. Me too.
Will any
of
you
consider... I keep checking his
Instagram
to see if he's going to post something, but he doesn't.
Will any of you consider now sending Anthrax to yourself just to see if Netflix is interested?
Yeah, I mean...
You know, okay, have you all read Trust Me, I'm Lying?
No.
I can't remember the name. Oh, it'll open your eyes on a lot of stuff. But like, there's some black magic you can play with to promote yourself. So the guy that wrote it, whose name presently escapes me, wrote a book called Trust Me, I'm Lying. And he was a PR guy. And at one point he was doing PR for Tucker Max, I think is the name of the fellow.
Guy? Yes.
Max had just done a book called I Hope They Serve Beer in Hell.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And what the PR guy would do.
That should be my job, that guy.
He would rent billboards in towns, then he would deface the billboard himself.
Oh, right.
Then he would email all of the local news teams and be like, "Have you seen this? This Tucker Max guy is really controversial. People keep defacing his billboards," and he would precipitate. So like you could, if easy tip for anybody that wants to make some money right now, if you write a book, immediately go to the most progressive college campus you can find and then send a bunch of inflammatory emails to all of the local social justice chat. Try to get yourself canceled, because then you can get. So there are ways to do this, but I don't want to play with that black magic. That seems like a monkey's paw type thing where I'm going to end up losing my house or something. And I'll
Hasan should have just been more careful. He was absolutely right to play.
This actually did happen in China when I was living there a few years ago. I had friends who were connected with the local state, like the giant stadium, the 10,000 seat Shanghai, whatever auditorium or whatever. And man, I want to say it was Justin Bieber, but I could be wrong on the person. So I don't know. This is odd to say. But anyway, let's say it was Justin Bieber, for example. He was booked to perform at the stadium. It got to 2 weeks out before the show. He had only sold like half the tickets. And so he claimed that the Chinese government banned him and shut him down. And he never went to China. I had contacts within the stadium with being like, that wasn't the case at all. They were welcoming him
smart
in.
Move.
Everything was fine. Yeah. But it was a
Very
way
smart.
To be like, no, it was Bieber. It was 100% it was Bieber. Now I remember. Because then he also on the same trip had someone carry him. It's a great picture you can Google of Justin Bieber on the Great Wall. And he was too tired to walk, so he had his giant bodyguards carry him like a baby up the Great Wall.
He is the... What was the Justin Bieber roast? Jeff, what's his name, referred to him as the King Joffrey of pop music.
That's beautiful. That's beautiful.
That sounds very accurate.
Hey, Turner, one thing we forgot, we could maybe do this, reverse engineer this, but there was an episode a few years ago, Lost in America, when I worked for Robert De Niro and a bomb was sent to his office. And we went on, and I used to open the mail for Robert De Niro all the time. I actually would have powder that we thought might be anthrax, wasn't anthrax. I was not there the day of the bomb, but we did an episode where I think we pretended I was opening the mail that day. So we failed to get any traction with that, but maybe now we can get someone to write an article about how we lied about this.
Yes! And maybe we can get canceled.
We can get canceled.
All right, let's all agree to write an article about
We also marked ourselves
our
safe on Facebook that day, and no one cared.
Yeah, mark myself safe. We should mark ourselves safe today based on this article, but yeah.
All right. New plan. All of us, we need to try harder to get canceled. We did a poll previously about who's going to get canceled first. Me. Thank you, everyone who voted.
Yep.
But now let's have a race and see who can get canceled first, because I think that clearly is the way forward. All right, guys. I think we've solved the dilemma. We agree. Hasan Minhaj is a national treasure, and we think he should keep doing what he's doing. Where can we all find you?
I was going to say, I was about to send anthrax to the girl who rejected me from high school, so I've got it.
Yeah. Cap, you do that, and we'll bring you on next time. Heaton, where can people who aren't already following you find your stuff?
If you're not already following me, you can follow me on The Political Orphanage, which is my main gig. And I've had guests that might be relevant to our conversation. One that's coming up, I've got Yasha Munk coming on here in a couple of weeks. And that might be of interest to people that enjoyed this conversation. So check out The Political Orphanage.
Very good. Cap Turner, where can talk to us about Lost in America? What's going on with you guys?
Go ahead, Cap.
Oh no, this Lost in America, which is our podcast. I could tell Turner the question. LostInAmericaPod.com.
I don't believe a word you're saying.
Who do we have on last week, Turner?
Oh my gosh! All right, I'll take over. I was trying to give you airtime here. We host a show called Lost in America. We put it out every single week. We talk to comedians around the world about the global news events happening in their country. Our most recent podcast last week, we had Peja Bajovic. Shut up, Kaplan. We had Peja Bajovic. Talk us about in April or May of this year, there was a couple of mass gun shootings in Serbia. Serbia's response was to try to get 90% of guns off the street of the country, out of the hands of the people. We checked in last week to see how that is going with Serbia. There's always this story that, anytime we have a shooting in America, we go, you know what? Australians, they're so much smarter. They banned guns in 1992 and they've never had a shooting. Well, it turns out they had 12 guns in the country to begin with. So it's not a good test case for us. Serbia has a more American level of guns in the country. So we dove into that to see how that's going. So check us out. Lost in America podcast, available wherever you get podcasts.
Awesome. And I'm Andrea Jones, where I host the Majoring in Everything podcast about the secret superpowers of people who do more than one seemingly unrelated thing. And I have a new YouTube series coming out of data science videos. So we're going to have a lot of fun. It's Andrea Jones Roy, Jones Roy on YouTube, Instagram, etc. All right, guys, that's what we got for today. I'll see you all at Hassan's next show.
Great. Thanks, all.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile. And the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time. There's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.